More could be inside the vans. Sun Bak Kim became a statue. Fear widened her eyes. While they tried to blind us, unseen gunmen sprayed shots into the sky. That told me that it wasn't La Policia Nacional de Uruguay. Eyes focused, shotgun asked. Four horsemen? Might be. You still ain't in no condition for a fight. You can't even walk 10 feet without falling. I'm as good as I'm gonna get until I get better. Me or the Bajan, if it comes down to it, we fight Medianoche, not you. It's decided. We'd already had that talk while you were halfway dead and in a coma. Didn't know a showdown would come this quick. Sun Bak Kim closed her eyes, said rapid prayers in Castellano, beat the steering wheel, begged God to save her and her stupid husband, said they would become better Christians. The truck carrying Hawks, the Bajan, and Constantine backed up until it was next to us. I pushed my door open so we could roll out. Shotgun didn't hesitate, followed my lead. Hawks, the Bajan, and Constantine did the same. The welcoming committee sent shots into the air. We sent shots into the air, a response to their call. Only, it had sounded like 30 of them, at least. Didn't know if they had a sniper, or two. I was half past dead, and now we were outnumbered and outgunned. Shotgun and the Bajan aimed their guns behind us, in case we'd been surrounded. We couldn't tell. Didn't know if this was what was left of the four horsemen, or bloodthirsty surrogates. Sun Bak Kim leapt out of the truck, and she dashed toward the enemy, ran in the storm, the wind pushing against her petite frame, and she screamed one word over and over. The bitch was shrieking out my name, like she wanted the team to know they had brought the prize. Chung Ho Kim shouted after his wife. He tried to take off running, but the Bajan did a spin kick and dropped him hard to the road. Constantine snapped and pointed his weapon at Chung Ho Kim's head. The Russian in Constantine came to life. He became the man in the white shoes, a man who had created business for many grave diggers. The kindness in the Bajan was gone, too. The Bajan yelled,
"We need to flank! Move to get a better position!"
Constantine commanded,
"We don't have the numbers!"
I said, "We don't know if we're already surrounded!" Soaking wet, Constantine had his weapon aimed at Chung Ho Kim's head.
"Are we surrounded? How many are out there? Talk, or I'll blow a hole in your head right now."
Hawks was in sniper mode, had her weapon trained on the running Korean woman as she ran into the storm. Hawks was steady, calculating wind and distance, ready to drop her before she reached whoever was waiting. The Korean woman and this sniveling man were part of this ambush. They were decoys, pawns who would be sacrificed to achieve a goal. The panicked man at our feet knew he was already dead. The woman who claimed to be his wife would die too. Then we'd kill as many of them as we could while they tried to kill all of us. Chapter 10. The Strange Woman. Sun Bak Kim screamed and ran into their headlights. She was about 50 yards away. Then all of the lights turned off at the same moment, and darkness showered us, forced us to let our eyes adjust. The lights came back on, blinded us again. Moments later, our driver came back our way, stumbling backward, two men with her. Neither was very tall, but they wore dark uniforms. I'd have bet they were bulletproof. One of the men marched at her side as he held her arm and guided her, had what looked like a Glock pointed at her head, her back into our headlights. The other walked behind her, held what looked like an Uzi, ready to spray and pray. Hawks had cover behind the truck. Weapon up, she maintained her aim, ready to return fire. She hadn't taken the shot. The wind. She wanted to save the bullet for a sure shot. Constantine called out,
"What can we do for you on this cold, rainy evening?"
Sun Bak Kim yelled into the night,
"Gideon, please, tell them you are the Gideon."
The Bajan and Shotgun, like Hawks, kept their weapons trained. The Bajan said,
"Someone looking for you especially."
I asked Constantine, "What did the other horseman who attacked you look like?"
"He was older, about the same age as Medianoche, had a patch of gray."
"That's not him?"
"No, his accent was American. I'd say West Coast, but military has influenced his speaking pattern. These are not Americans. The other man, Medianoche's leader, we left him with a knife in his back. They called him the Beast. He's too fucked up to be out here."
I went to Chung Ho Kim, grabbed him by his neck, and forced him back against the truck. Growled when I propelled him hard.
I expected him to fight back, and that fight would be a quick fight that wouldn't end in his favor. But he covered his head, terrified, fell to the ground, was praying and shitting his pants. I told him he had one chance to answer, one chance only, to tell me who that woman was who had driven me, the woman who was so inquisitive, and tell me who had paid them to sell us out, and who the men were on the other side of those headlights. They were the barrier between us and our escape to Brazil. He told us she was his wife. They had a child. He told me the same things she had told me. That meant nothing. It could have been rehearsed long before. I asked, "Then why did she run?" "She abandoned you and ran." He said, "My wife is afraid, and she does impulsive things. I love her, but she's stupid." I left him on the ground, and I stood up, groaned, and felt the weight of the rain. I walked to my team, told them to cover me. They looked at me like I'd gone mad. I said, "They want Gideon. I'm going out there, unarmed." Hawks stepped in front of me and barked, "Don't take stupid to a brand new level." I moved around her. The Bajan told me to think twice. Konstantin said the same in Russian, but it was too late. Arms stretched out to my sides, fingers spread apart. I went toward them, strode through puddles, took easy steps toward the woman who was in the rain, a gun held to her head, losing her mind and screaming my name like I was their target. Hawks had been right. I had pulled them all into my personal shit. I knew they would all die to save me, but I'd rather die to save them. I marched through puddles, moved at an even, non-hostile pace, arms extended, anticipating being shot by their version of James Earl Ray. Then, I was less than 5 yards shy of the armed men. Both were dressed in all black, the attire of a Spanish militia. Both had lean builds, strong upper bodies like champion brawlers, from what I could tell. My face cringed with pain, and I limped the last few steps, rain weighing my hoodie down. I told them, "Soy Gideon. Me buscan caballeros. No levo armas." I asked the gentlemen if they were looking for me, and said I was unarmed. Arms still extended, fingers wide apart. I looked at one, then the other, to see who was the leader. No response as they sized me up. Two against one. They had the guns. They knew they had me. Again, I told them that I was Gideon, repeated that I did not have a weapon. I said, "The girl is afraid. Move the gun from her head." One hard ass finally found his voice and spoke up, said, "Fuck you, asshole. Put the gun on me. This is between us." The other one found his voice and echoed, "Fuck you, asshole." She said,
"I begged him. Tell them you are not the four horsemen, that none of you are the ones they want, that you are the one they call Gideon, and you are running from the horsemen."
I took another step, and the taller one moved his gun from her head and pointed it at my face. His friend was broader, looked powerful. He did the same, pointed his gun at me. I told Sunbok Kim, "Go back to your husband. Tell my friends to not shoot. But if they do, to try not to shoot me, especially the girl. She might shoot me to get a laugh." Eyes wide, body shaking, she looked at the men. She was soaking wet, cold, beyond terrified. I repeated, "Go back to your husband. Run." She did what I told her. The stocky man redirected his gun at her, ready to pop her as she fled, but I stepped in the path of the shot. That angered him. He came closer. He pointed his gun at my chest, stabbed me with the death end of the weapon, and I kept my hands up, submitting. I closed my eyes, and he laughed. He thought I was wounded and afraid, called me a coward. Then I moved so fast it was a blur, grabbed the barrel of the gun with my left hand, gripped the slider, then hit him twice with my right fist. That hurt my already damaged hands. 2 moves later, his nose was bloodied, and I had his weapon pointed at his face. He didn't know what had happened. Neither did his co-worker. Before he could raise his gun and take aim, I had my newly acquired weapon aimed at the center of his head. He cursed, surrendered his gun without saying a word. I put his gun in my waistband, then clocked him with the butt of the gun I was holding. Clocked him hard, and he was on the ground with his homie, his mouth twice as bloodied. I repeated, "Soy Gideon, They stood up, wiped rain from their faces, looked at each other like they were in trouble. I asked, ¿Dónde está tu maldito jefe? They pointed toward their headlights. The big boss was out here in the rain. I said, Let's go to Oz and have a talk with the wizard. The taller one asked, Por favor, first, may I have my gun back? Fuck you, asshole. And if you plan on asking the same question, fuck you too. We walked about halfway, and I stood behind them, used them as human shields. I had my hostages call out, tell their boss that Senor Gideon was here seeking an audience, and he was pissed. A moment later, there was movement on their side. It looked like a huge shadow came my way, but it was a large figure and a smaller figure. The larger figure was almost 7 feet tall, very tall for a man in this region, and carried a black umbrella. When they were close, I saw the smaller figure had hips and curves. She wore a gray winter coat, one that was impermeable, over a black dress, fancy black tights, and heeled boots, hair pulled into a tight bun. She was very presidential. In heels, she was 5'6", but thought she was 6'5", had about 40 years of attitude inside of a body that couldn't have been more than 30. She was attractive, in a dark way. The fashionable woman calmly said, Buenas noches. Buenas noches. She stood in the rain, expressionless, a woman of steel. The short woman, wearing diamonds and pearls, evaluated my existence in her world. I asked, Who are you? I am the one who will decide your fate and the fate of all who wait behind you. Since I have the guns, I will be deciding your fate as well. May I borrow one of my men's guns? Do I look crazy? Trust me. Not trusting me is a bad way to start a negotiation. I handed a gun to her, but kept the second aimed at her. Without hesitation, she shot both of her men, cranium shots. With their dead bodies resting at our feet, she shot them again, shot each 2 more times, then sighed and handed me back the smoking gun. She did that, then adjusted her coat as if nothing had happened. She said, See, now we have established some level of trust. The big man next to her, he feared the small woman. It was in his eyes, weak links dead at her feet, like she was Dame Judy. She saw that the over-the-top display didn't rattle me. Senor Gideon, who do you work for on this lovely evening? Yesterday, when we were in Buenos Aires, I worked for a couple named Scamps. And today, Senor Gideon, which couple do you work for today? No one, senorita. No one. Thinking about filing for unemployment. Why are you in my country, if not to challenge us on our own land? Just passing through to get to Brazil. Why Brazil? I want to meet that girl from Ipanema everybody sings about. She remained stoic. Let's talk serious. Let's. For a man named Scams, you met the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. 3 horsemen of the apocalypse. One of them is dead. I killed him on a train. The Beast or Medianoche? A young guy. Well-built, Spanish, frowns when stabbed, can't take a punch. Señor Rodriguez. He was a very handsome man. If you say so, that horseman did his last gallop on the morning train. If that is the truth, the Beast and Medianoche won't rest until you are dead. Well, they are my adversaries of the week. They are our adversaries as well. But are we adversaries? At the moment, no. You're blocking my way on this carretera in a very comprehensive and hostile manner. I have allowed you to come this far. I could have destroyed all of you in Montevideo. The long-haired American girl, I could have had her executed the moment she landed in this country. We could have attacked you when you were resting in the hotel. Understand? Look, it's cold. I'm wet. I'm tired. We need to cross the border into Brazil. The girl from Ipanema? You know it, she said, as a courtesy. You may continue. But all of my favors come at a price. What's your price?
One day, I will reach out to you and call in this favor.
I don't want any bullshit. We could just battle it out right here.
We could, but it wouldn't serve either of us, other than for ego. The briefcases are no longer in play. Therefore, I have nothing to gain by wasting ammunition at this moment.
You've already lost enough men over in Buenos Aires. She smiled.
I'm being generous. Don't be ungrateful.
I said, you'll let my crew pass, sin problema.
You are the Gideon. Your word is all the currency needed.
And what do they call you?
Abeja Reina. I am the queen bee.
Looks like you have a militia. I'm one man. Nothing I can do for you.
But some things are out of my jurisdiction.
I told her, once, at my discretion. I won't go on a suicide run, not like yesterday. She shook her head.
Once, you will not get to choose. That is not how this works. You don't come to my country and tell me what you will and will not do like you're my president.
A second passed, with us staring at each other. Not friends. Never would be. With a handful of friends behind me, and an untold number of guns in front of us, instead of popping her in the head, then doing the same to her guard, instead of starting a firefight on this road in the freezing rain, I gave a stone face to the expressionless woman and capitulated. This wicked business was determined to not let me leave. At least, not alive. I told her, once, to get my associates out of your country. Once, and we're done. My friends are not involved, will not be involved, and will never owe you anything. They don't exist to you. They are invisible. This fucked up deal will be between me and you. No backlash for them.
I will decide the manner in which this debt will be paid. I write the fucked up deal.
Write it, but only put my name on it. No compromise on that. I don't care how many guns you have hiding in the dark. It will be paid by me. Once. Then our business will be done. A moment passed before she said,
this will be between us.
I asked, how will you find me when you need to call in a favor? For the first time, she grinned.
I will contact someone who knows how to find you.
I doubt if we run in the same circles.
Queen Scams. You know her as Arizona? She will contact you on my behalf.
My blood became as icy as my skin. We looked in each other's eyes, shook cold hands. She said,
if I were smart, I would require that once to be now.
A storm is coming.
I am sure it would love for you to be here when it arrived.
Sorry, a tall, tanned, young, and lovely girl from Ipanema is waiting.
I am sure she will be waiting for you in Eterma. Estamos hasta las manos. Igualmente.
She came closer to me, stood inches away, then raised her small hand, gently touched the side of my wounded face. She tightened her jaw, then touched my arms, squeezed my muscles, nodded. She licked her lips, stepped away, looked behind her, signaled that everything was fine. She turned to me and said,
I believe you have something that belongs to me.
I don't think so.
We must maintain the trust we have created.
I handed her the guns. She held one in each hand. She said,
same arrogance, same rhythm. You walk like one of them.
One of who?
One of the four horsemen.
The three horsemen, unless they kept a spare in the closet.
You walk like you have testicles the size of coconuts.
That explains the chafing. She tried to see past my injuries, compared me to a horseman. Before she could make a connection, I turned around, jogged toward my crew. Every step let me know how bad I had been injured across the river, but I put on a show, pretended pain wasn't attached to me like a tick. The anxious, foolish men on the other side fired rapid shots into the air, men and women. As I jogged, the bus started up. I heard that engine crank up behind me, and the vans revved their engines in response. all moved and cleared away so we could pass. I didn't learn it until later, but 30 minutes after we crossed into Brazil, there was a firefight back at the blockade. The Queen Bee knew they were coming, had been waiting on them, not us. She wanted a fight. She wanted to defend her land like she was part of a street gang in South Central Los Angeles. Medianoche had arrived looking for us, the woman they called Senorita Raven at his side. The beast wasn't there. My assumption was that he was wounded. Medianoche had different people instead, a crew who didn't dress like horsemen. The mercenaries had enlisted guns for hire. Half the people we had seen at the blockade were long dead by the time I boarded a plane in Rio. So were most of the men that Medianoche and Senorita Raven had brought along. The Queen Bee had sacrificed all, run the horsemen back across the river. Their fight was personal, not on my behalf. Still, part of me wished I had let my crew go without me and stayed behind. Our victory in Buenos Aires had been pyrrhic at best, even for scams in Arizona. But it was my duty to make sure my team made it to safe ground. I died once, and a man named Midnight had been killed once. Both of us owed death. We had cheated death. Like father, like son. Medianoche would find me and seek revenge for what had been done to Midnight. Or I'd find him before he found Catherine and the boys. That was already written in the books of hell. I don't know why he tried to kill my mother, but even when I was 7 years old, I knew that Medianoche and I were not meant to walk the same earth. Every ache in my battered body confirmed that. One of us would die again. Mine or his. That second death would be the last. Chapter 11. Black Angel. Raincoat over his Colombian suit, black umbrella up high, one gun resting in the small of his back, two more inside holsters underneath his coat, and two blades on his person, Medianoche stood under the enormous rubber tree, the famous Gomero in Plaza Francia. He was near Café La Biela, and where prostitutes worked inside the discos, close to the drove of tourists going into La Recoleta Cemetery to give their respects to Eva Perón, not far from McDonald's and Village Cines. The rubber tree had been planted in the 1800s by the Recoleta brothers, and now was 20 meters wide and 50 meters high, a shade tree, much needed in Argentina's brutal, humid summers, that now served as an umbrella that kept much of the rain from falling. Much, not all. A young woman with the hue of a Moor stood with Medianoche and looked up at the tree. Luggage at her side, umbrella in hand, the former soldier was absolutely amazed. She said, "I've never seen a tree like this, sir. It's ginormous, as wide as a park." When she spoke, he could see the braces on her teeth. He took his attention from her and watched as city buses, tour buses, trucks, and a million cars raced along Avenida del Libertador. The four horsemen had chased the scams organization down that boulevard, guns blazing, what felt like a few hours ago. He whispered, "Gideon." They had been so close to catching that gaucho in Uruguay. The young woman broke his gaze when she said, "Sir?" He faced the recruit who had just arrived from North America. She shivered in the weather. It was 12 degrees Celsius. That would be about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. He'd grown used to the metric system. The USA had been stubborn and not kept up with the times, like an aging soldier. The dampness made the air feel colder. He thought about Caprica Ortiz, Las Leñas. Had to be good snow at the resorts. The recruit said, "It's both an honor and a pleasure to finally meet you, sir." He let her stand in the rain, in the cold, in uncomfortable silence. She added, "And I am sad to hear the beast is no longer with us."
"I am your commanding officer. Will there be an issue?"
"No, sir. The beast spoke highly of you during our last conversation. He said that you were an outstanding soldier, a warrior, a fearless man who was the best executive officer." He had come to meet her alone. If it did not go well, if she was not to his liking despite her resume and having already been vetted by the beast, he would put her down. She wore a military-style jacket over two wife beaters, old Navy gear that stood out as North American apparel. North Americans had become slouchy, had become a nation of bums. Men disgraced suits by wearing tennis shoes and called it fashion. He took in the recruit. The women in Argentina did their eyebrows differently and were all about brunette hair. They did not like their mane short and did not like it to be seen with gray. This girl had big hair, a curly, feral afro, thick like wool, wild like a forest of black kudzu, toned body, but not masculine. Medianoche stood before her and asked, "What is your government name, soldier?" She held her own umbrella, took a breath, and said, "Kiana Sapphire Savage?" He asked, "Where are you from originally?" She told Medianoche she was from New York, but had been born in the West Indies, Dominican, identified with Carib, Kiskiano, or Taino Indians, depending on the day of the week. Medianoche asked, "What issues did Uncle Sam have with you?" "There was an unauthorized absence when I left post to go hook up with someone."
"Hook up?"
"To have sexual intercourse, sir."
"You left your post to go get laid? You put your men in jeopardy to go cock chasing."
"I also violated a general order and attempted escape from custody when I was arrested."
"Tell me about the fight that happened when you were confronted."
"Took four men to subdue me. Three of those bitches couldn't do the job."
"How did that turn out?"
"Broke a couple collarbones, not mine. Broke noses, again not mine. Broke an arm, not mine. When they came to drag me to the brig, it took them 20 minutes to take me down."
"You were wrong. You left your comrades at risk and fucked up three or four more."
"I am embarrassed for doing so, sir. But what they did was no way to treat a woman."
"Was the fuck worth it?"
"No, sir. Not worth it. 2 minutes of pleasure for a life of trouble. Didn't even nut, sir."
"There is a time for everything. Understand?"
"Understood."
"I would have put a bullet in your head for abandoning my team."
"Should I leave? Should I head back to America?"
"You're in America."
"I'm in Argentina, sir."
"You're in America. Argentina is in South America, and South America is just as America as the America from where you arrived. These are the Americas. From the top of Canada to the end of South America is America. The USA isn't the only America. Don't forget that."
"I won't forget that, sir. But can I explain what led to that bad decision?"
"Explain why you were irresponsible and put your comrades at risk."
"My older brother had died in Iraq. I had to get away. Having sex was just a way of medicating myself. I had to do something that made me feel alive and connected to the universe. I know that's no excuse, but that's what I did. That's why I was so angry. I fought everyone who put their hands on me. I wanted to fight the entire world. It was wrong, very wrong. But I had lost my only sibling in Iraq. We all grieve differently."
"What was the verdict handed down?"
"Dismissed with a bad conduct discharge, reduction in rank to pay grade E1, and was locked up for 9 months. Because I had one bad night, made one bad decision."
"How many bad decisions does it take to cost lives?"
"One, sir. One."
"You're a fuck up. Own it."
Medianoche pulled out a gun, silencer attached. She stepped back, afraid. Medianoche motioned toward the entrance of the Cimiterio de la Recoleta, toward the city of the dead that was a potpourri of everything from neoclassical, neo-Gothic, Art Nouveau, and Art Deco.
"There is a man inside. Gray suit, black tie. Was a soldier here in the 80s. The cemetery is a well-planned town for the dead. Neat city blocks with street names at every intersection. Walk past the feral cats. The directions are in red. He will be near the space marked number 95, the grave for Rufina Cambaceres. The target's wife is buried in the adjoining mausoleum."
Without questioning, she responded,
"Yes, sir."
"Tell him you came to see him on behalf of the missing 30,000.
She repeated, "The missing 30,000.
"Then blow his fucking brains out. If anyone is with him, send them on the same trip."
He handed her a 9-inch tactical combat bowie knife sleeping in its sheath.
"Bring me his ears.
and his tongue. Proof of death. Without hesitation, she took the knife. She put the gun in the small of her back, then put the knife in the pocket of her jacket before she fluffed her wild hair. She picked her umbrella up and took the stone walkway. She passed by a waiter dressed in black, carrying a silver tray, taking fresh coffee to some lazy fuck who wouldn't come out in the rain. Medianoche watched Kiana Savage as she passed by the waiter and others without a second look, watched the way she moved until she disappeared into the city of the dead. She was focused. She had blocked out everything but that which was important. Then a teen carrying a baby came to Medianoche, one of the tens of thousands who lived in the Argentine slums. Girls, like her, sat on every corner, in front of every shopping area, on every street, baby in arms, hand outstretched. He gave her his pocket change. She thanked him, became teary-eyed, and moved on, hand outstretched to others. Medianoche took out his phone, called Caprico Ortiz. He said, "It's being handled as we speak. Another one will be in hell soon."
"Good. I have more intel for you."
"More information for me? Or another contract from you?"
"The woman you say is the mother of Gideon. She is living in Atlanta. I have her passport information. I have an address where she lives. She has two sons living in her house."
"Is Gideon one of those sons? Is one of them an adult?"
"Both are boys in primary school. Nothing more on Gideon yet."
"Photos?"
"She is not on social media, but I will ask for photos."
"Keep trying. I need to be 100% sure it's her. Just like you want to be sure that the men you send me to visit are the right men, I want to be sure about the woman who has been to me what evil men have been to you. I need to be sure that the right one is found."
"If that is what she is to you, then you will kill her."
"I will kill her. Like I have never killed anyone. I lost my eye because of esa mierda puta."
"Then I will check again and let you know. I will make sure she is the right one."
Chapter 12. Kiss the blood off my hands. 10 minutes later, Kiana Savage exited the cemetery. She casually walked by religious Argentine women, standing in the rain offering hugs for free, past children selling flowers, by other sidewalk vendors. This area was the tourist epicenter, the part of the city that felt the safest during the day. When Savage stopped and faced Medianoche, she opened a bag she carried. Inside were the ears and tongue. Blood was on her clothing, on the backs of her hands. He took the bag, dropped it in the trash, then said, "Good job, Savage."
"Thank you, sir. The cemetery is amazing, breathtaking. This area is off the chains."
She picked up her luggage and followed him with the cadence of an eager soldier. He asked, "Are you hungry?"
"Famished, sir. I've been on a low-carb diet for the last 6 months."
"Well, your starving days are about to come to an end." She exhaled, like she wanted to cry.
"Thanks for the opportunity, sir. I will prove to you that I am no longer a fuck-up. I will earn my keep."
"I'm sorry about your brother."
"Thank you, sir."
"Nothing hurts like losing a brother."
10 minutes later, they're on Posadas, inside of the swank restaurant, Fervor. Savage had gone to the bathroom, cleaned herself up, and come back wearing a Lakers hoodie. He said,
"This will be your last day dressing the way you do."
"Sir, yes, sir."
"You won't dress like a hooligan."
They were seated across from each other, underneath chandeliers at a white tablecloth table. Argentine steaks had been ordered. The new recruit was looking at the people, the city, eyes wide, amazed by everything she saw. Medianoche looked at her, black and beautiful. He never understood why gorgeous women wanted to be in the military. He never understood why so many blacks lined up to fight for a country that would never fight for them. The USA's military was to maintain dominance of the white man and no one else. That was what his father had told him many times, usually when he was in a flag-waving, drunken stupor. The new recruit took to the steak and vegetables like she hadn't had a meal for 3 days,
Maybe hadn't had a decent meal in as long as 3 weeks. It was like watching a poor child in a Dickens novel. It was sad. This is what became of many when war was done. The door to the restaurant opened. Several suited men entered, marched in from the rain. One flipped the sign on the restaurant door from abierto to cerrado, from open to closed. Another moved forward. He was Nigerian. Medianoche stood, faced them all. Savage stopped eating and did the same, stood by Medianoche's side, showing her commitment to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Medianoche handed her his second gun.
Shoot those bitches in the heart.
She shot 5 times. Those 5 rapid shots popped 5 gorillas in the chest. The 5 gorillas stumbled backward into the others, then looked down at their clothing, touched where the bullets had hit, pulled their hands back. There was no blood. Then, one by one, 4 of the 5 laughed. The release of nervous energy. Just as many were behind them. The other men and women laughed, too. At that moment, as if on cue, the suited mercenaries moved to the side. Medianoche adjusted his blood-red tie. Dressed in her Colombian suit, wearing the black tie of a horseman, Senorita Raven marched by them all. Her walk had authority. She turned and regarded her squad. She walked from one to the next, their second in command, inspecting her team. 6'6", 235 pounds, albino, called himself Tiburon, the shark. Born in the islands, had 6 fingers on each hand, 6 toes on each foot. He was a great fighter, a sniper, could handle most weapons, especially the one at his side. The man next to him stood at 5'7". Dr. Spots weighed 160. He had vitiligo and could be brown-skinned or white, achieved by applying makeup to either the light patches or darker patches of his flesh. He was a good follower. Behind him was a broad-shouldered black man, the Butcher. Next to him was an Afro-Nicaraguan, Black Mamba. They moved to the side, and once again, Ibo the Nigerian came to the front. He stood at 6'9", weighed a solid 390. The Cobra appeared next to Ibo. All muscle, had more strength than Lithuanian strongman Zdrunas Savicka. There was a British soldier, Clutterbuck, 6'1", athletic, 180 on the scales. Next to him was a woman from Dearborn, Michigan. She was a Pakistani woman named Javeria. She had joined the military on court order to avoid doing time for an armed robbery when she was a teen, 2 tours of duty under her belt. There was an Israeli woman, Reina. She was out of Newhall, California. She had worked as an assassin since her dishonorable discharge and had 12 more kills under her belt outside of the 20 she had earned for Uncle Sam. There was a Mexican who called himself Chico Blanco, a soccer-playing pussy chaser. He had come home from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD as a souvenir. He stood next to a woman who wore a gray Colombian suit and white preacher's collar. Curvy and blonde, built like South African actress Charlize Theron, only with a Cajun accent. She called herself Preacher. The only thing Preacher loved more than war was God. The Bible told her all she needed to know. It was all she read. All had left the military on bad terms and had been uncertain about their futures. These were his bullet catchers, his new set of disposables. Medianoche said,
"Horsemen, be seated."
Senorita Raven nodded. "Let's break bread and tell war tales." Medianoche listened to the new horseman bond, talk about battle experiences, about the Middle East, about atrocities, about the things that soldiers had done to Middle Eastern women and their children, about the walking wounded, about the men and women who wouldn't make it home, about those who had, and now were, sleeping in storefronts. His phone rang. It was Caprico Ortiz. He stood to the side and answered. The enemy had been located. She said, "I know where he is hiding, but he is moving, and he changes his location very often, once a day. So you must be quick." Medianoche called Preacher to the side. He said,
"I've reviewed your files."
"Sir, yes, sir."
3 tours of duty."
"Sir, yes, sir."
"I read about the incident."
"The men who were involved, There was no punishment.
You ended up in California?
Working as a security guard at a Mexican food chain out in West Covina. But I did wet work as well. Small jobs. I wanted to get on with the LAPD. I wanted to become a special weapons tactics officer. Or become part of the sheriff's department, but my military record.
Medianoche nodded. Didn't want to get into the details of her past, and moved on. She was sleek, fierce, healthy, good skin. He had seen her legs yesterday. She had strong, amazing calves and a tight ass, and she had kept busy doing assassin's work. She was ready.
Preacher, I have an assignment for you. You will be team leader. You have to go back to the States. I'm not sure where yet.
No problem, sir. I'll be returning to U.S. soil as a horseman.
I will let you pick 3 horsemen to complete your squad.
May I pick Senorita Raven? Her reputation precedes her.
So does yours, soldier.
That's not what I was implying, sir.
My XO stays here. We have to get all of you acclimated to being horsemen and to South America. Outside of the issue in the States, we have other international work to be coordinated, important work. But before we move on, we need to take care of some old horseman business.
I won't disappoint you. I've never failed a mission.
You're confident.
Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him.
Medianoche countered the biblical quote with one of his own.
Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling.
You know the word of the Lord.
My father beat it into me. Church every Sunday from early morning until late afternoon. He was as religious as he was alcoholic.
Never would have guessed you'd be able to quote anything besides the Art of War.
Believe in God, but watch your 6 and trust your weapon on the battlefield. Everybody has a God, and a man's God or Allah or whatever he believes has never stopped anyone in any religion from dying in combat. Trust your gun during, then thank your God you survived after.
Sir, yes, sir.
I will let you know when the time has come. It may be tomorrow, it may be a week, could be a month. In the meantime, get to know your fellow horsemen. Be ready to choose and create a secondary team.
Sir, yes, sir.
And you are to destroy all. Is that a problem?
I will destroy all like they are the Amalekite nation.
Dismissed. 2 hours later, Medianoche exited a radio taxi on Avenida Pueyrredón. He walked a block, made sure no one was on his tail, then took a private entrance into Hospital Alemán. When he turned around, Senorita Raven was there, not hiding, but tracking as she had done in the past. She was in point-blank range before he said,
"You're following me?"
"Is there a contract here? Like the one you just had Savage do in the cemetery?"
"Why are you trailing my every move?"
"I'm protecting you. We know the issues you have."
He snapped. "Vamos a los bifes." "You freeze."
"I'm concerned. I'm doing my fucking job as your XO. I have your back. Do what you have to do, and I will be here, locked and loaded. I will make sure no enemy comes up behind you while you are vulnerable. Just let me do what your XO needs to do, sir."
He conceded. "Wait in the hallway."
"Is this another part of the Caprica Ortiz contract?"
"No. I have an appointment. Nothing major."
"I will, sir. I will stand sentry. You made your decisions, but since we're not with the others, I have to say that I should be your driver as well, just as you were the Beast's driver. From here on out, I drive you. That is not negotiable. Walking in the open like this leaves us vulnerable. We're back in the Mercedes, rocking bulletproof windows and run flat tires. You are our leader and must be protected above everything else."
He nodded. She was right. Then he moved through the hospital's private section. Medianoche was there for a fucking brain scan. The pain in his missing eye was without pause. He'd had too many blackouts. Like the best plane, battleship, or tank, the body could last only so many wars. Damage had been done. The older a man, the longer he took to heal. He felt the injury when he inhaled, felt it when he exhaled. Each ache,
took him back to Gideon. He heard every lie that Gaucho had told while they were in battle. That son of a whore, Gideon, had claimed that Medianoche was his father. Either a lie that had been told to him, or Gideon had simply chosen to tell a lie. The whore's son had looked too much like the beast to be anyone else's mutt. Chapter 13. No questions asked. Constantine Hawks and Shotgun escaped north to the Alpha Global city, Sao Paulo. The Russian was the only one in that bunch who spoke any Portuguese and understood the culture, so they had to depend on him. They kept it moving, no time to take selfies. A contact there arranged new passports, and in Rio de Janeiro, another contact was doing the same for me. Shotgun headed to Atlanta. He wanted to drive by Powder Springs, see if he could find out where Catherine and the boys had gone. My only hope was that she wasn't dead and stuffed in a freezer with the boys. I worked in that kind of world. I knew because I had been paid to do worse, more than once. The things I had done for money would not be televised. I was back to depending on Shotgun. Once my coworker and friend checked on Catherine and tried to find out where she was with the boys, he was going to stop being Shotgun, become a hard-working blue-collar man named Alvin White again, then speed 2 hours east on I-20, get to Alabama, and check on his own family. Hawks stayed with Constantine, made sure he made it back home. The Russian's wife was impatiently waiting, and so was an appointment to get another round of chemotherapy. He was still in the ring, fighting cancer, still refusing to lose to man or God. Before we parted ways, Hawks said, "I haven't forgotten those two names. Jeremy Bentham from Smyrna, Nathalie Marie Massieles from here. Either I'll be in touch or I'll pass what I find on to Constantine. I still owe you for the BC powder. Pay Constantine, and he'll get my money to me." The green-eyed Bajan stayed in Rio at the safe house with me. It was a three-bedroom apartment in Leblon, the most affluent neighborhood in Rio. After the cold and damp safe house in Uruguay, stepping into a spot with white walls and comfortable furniture felt like I had died and gone to a hitman's heaven. The beach was right outside our window, across the street. I could hear the rhythmic roar of the sea. The winter here was about 24 degrees Celsius. That made it 75 degrees Fahrenheit during the day, and the temperature dropped at nights to a balmy 18 degrees Celsius, which was 64 degrees on that same Fahrenheit scale. It had weather like Southern California. The humidity was low, very tolerable, not like in the ATL. I saw people jogging all day, especially around noon. I was going to go to Angra dos Reis, but Rio was better. It would be easy for us to vanish into the area with more than 12 million people moving back and forth outside our door. Besides, I was hurting. It felt like I had broken every part of my body in that fight with Medianoche. I should have killed him again. But I wanted him to admit he was my father first. I wanted something my mother had told me since I was born to be true. The Bajan said, "I want to train you when you get better." "You think I need training? I kicked ass from the moment I arrived until I left." "You can always be better. We fall into bad habits and don't realize we have done so. You say you kicked ass, but you didn't walk away clean. You almost lost an eye." I took a few hits. "The point is not to get hit at all, or suffer minimal damage. I teach my daughters how to fight. They are almost untouchable. If you are close enough to hit them, then they are close enough to kill you. I don't teach them to trade blows. I teach them to end the fight, to win." I understood. They had sent the Bajan with me for a purpose. I said, "So, I take it you're my bodyguard, more or less? An assassin's assassin?" "No, not at all. I am here until morning. I have to get back to the Bahamas. Then I have to go home to California." "You have daughters?" "Two. They haven't met. One is in the Bahamas. One lives in the States." "You have any more kids?"
"I is a Bajan. We have kids everywhere."
That made me laugh. It's like that sometimes.
"You?"
"No kids. Never been in one spot long enough to think about that. Well, I thought about that once upon a time with a girl I met at a pool hall near Los Angeles, but that was years ago. I was a different man then." I'm training both of my daughters. I've trained them for years.
Just to fight, or to do what you do?
To be able to survive. To never back down. To always win.
I nodded, then said to the green-eyed man, I haven't seen you in a few years. You didn't have a name when I saw you last. I was new at the game. I might have still been a teenager.
Now you big man in the business.
Now I'm Gideon. I like that name. Wish I had thought of it first. I said, I thought you had left this business, one way or the other. He nodded.
I did collections, some contracts for some powerful people in the U.S. It's a dark company called RCSI.
Never heard of them.
They're known as the barbarians in our profession.
Still, never heard of them.
I am beginning to wish I hadn't. It's turned out to be a problem. They don't like it when an employee wants his freedom once again.
You're telling me that you're on the run?
You could say that. But the man know when he catch me, he catch big trouble.
It sounded like he needed some help with a problem. But I was knee-deep in my own. I said, we'll talk. When this settles down, when it cools down, we can sit and chat.
No need to worry about me. I make a man regret the day he catches me.
I'm that way with women. We laughed. When I woke the next morning, the Bajan was gone. The West Indian man with the green eyes, smile, and Caribbean accent who had made Hawks' panties wet had left the safe house. He left a note, told me he would be in touch, left a number to reach him. I wanted to call Hawks to apologize again, but I didn't. I stayed in Rio de Janeiro, called Catherine over and over. Never got an answer. Constantine had set up for me to go to a doctor and get x-rays. I'd taken a lot of blows to the head, not just in Rio, but since the start of this career in wet works. I'd fought rappers, politicians, a man with a broken nose, a red-haired assassin and his wife. I'd fought too many fights. Each fight was a fight to the death. But I felt okay. My vision wasn't blurry. That merry-go-round had stopped going at 100 miles per hour. So I blew off that appointment. I wore clothes that were on the level of the people in my surroundings, dressed like the locals, and stuck to the south, the Zona Sul neighborhoods of Copa and Ipanema. My Portuguese made the tourists think I was Brazilian, and respectable enough to make Brazilians think I was an expatriate living in their country. An old man asked me what happened, and I told him I was attacked by a gang out of the Rochina favela, said I had gotten too close to the biggest slum in the world. He told me I was lucky to still be alive. I agreed. Within 2 days, with the help of BC powder, I was moving much better. Constantine called. Funds had been transferred. In Russian, he asked, Are you up to working, or should I pass on the Rio job? Send me the information. Do it. Then I will send you somewhere else. You've been there too long. I don't want to run. People have been chasing me for years. I'm tired of running. The horsemen are a mission for 1,000, or a mission for 1, and I can sneak back and be my own SEAL Team 6. You're not running. If it was only Medianoche, you could handle that. You're capable. But one man can't defeat an army. You're a man with a gun fighting a battalion of rocket launchers. Let's not be insane. They would have destroyed everyone in Buenos Aires to get to us. I need to know where Catherine and the boys are.
Be patient, my favorite son. Be patient. You are injured.
Now, let's talk about you. How's that cancer?
Like we did the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I will kick its ass.
If you don't kill it all, it comes back, sometimes stronger.
I may have a little cancer, but cancer does not have me. Chapter 14. Estafador. Scams had outsmarted the Four Horsemen. He had spread the word across the lands. He had not garnered as much as he had hoped, but in Buenos Aires, he had won. Now he was with his team on a $70 million superyacht, one that had a 6-cabin layout. The main deck was the master deck, and the upper deck was VIP. That was where he sat, leeward,
sipping champagne, an AR-15, and Glock at his side. He had 16 hired men, all in suits, all armed in the same fashion. They guarded the boat in shifts. Underway, astern, or resting, they moved from stern to starboard, to bow to port, and back to stern. No man ever sat or stopped moving. Men who moved couldn't fall asleep on the job. If one did, he had to swim home. They covered all three levels of the pleasure boat. Wherever Scams went, two armed guards stayed near. No one spoke to Scams. When he slept, they patrolled outside his door. No one had made him run before. No one had ever made him live in the middle of an ocean, too nervous to return to land. It was nighttime. In the distance, a cruise ship went by, unaware of his presence. Scams's vessel was not trackable. The automatic identification system had been disabled. Maritime authorities couldn't track his position, speed, location, or movements without AIS. The primary function of AIS was collision avoidance, but Scams had his crew track the position of other ships, especially any heading in their direction, and moved accordingly. They also used their eyes. At night, they could see the lights on other vessels, but now lightning was in the distance. Beautiful lightning. There was a storm out on the water. Winds picked up, and on the open seas, there were no buildings to block the brunt of it. When darkness hit and the rainfall touched his area, Scams moved inside. Polished wood, marble, made the presidential suite at the Four Seasons seem like a retreat for paupers. The yacht was the type of water transportation that would be used by a man who drove a $400,000 Bentley Mulsanne Speed that had a champagne chiller with three glasses and iPads built into the back seats. This vessel cost more than most made in their lifetimes. Life was about comfort, if nothing else. His six-bedroom home in Pacific Palisades and his Kensington Palace Gardens address were testaments to his taste, to where and how he existed in a world of losers. When he flew, if he wasn't in a private jet, flying instead with commoners in order to facilitate a scam, he traveled first class. Tickets were as much as 21 grand, but those were paid for by his lovers, women with addresses in Chelsea, the Boltons, Compton Avenue, Park Place Villas, Courtney Avenue, Mondresa Road, Victoria Road, and Notting Hill. Beverly Hills, Hollywood Hills, Park Avenue, Honolulu, Atherton, and Sagaponack. He was a good-looking man, tall and Latin, dressed well, and smelled like success. He was Scams, the con man of all.